This clip was recorded for the UK Wine Show. For more information about the UK Wine Show, you can go to ukwineshow.co.uk.
Hi, I'm here with James Miles from LiveX. How are you, James?
Good.
Excellent. We're going to be talking a wee bit about LiveX and a wee bit about how you guys make your money. Do you want to tell us a wee bit about yourself first, James? Are you a wine man or...?
Well, funnily enough, I'm not. I'm not a wine man. We started LiveX in 2000, but prior to that, I was a stockbroker. And we had this slightly crazy idea that we could build a marketplace for fine wine. And not surprisingly, we based that around the stock market model because that's what we knew and that's what we understood.
We were talking earlier and you were talking about different competitors when you first started out. A lot of them were looking to try and take out the middleman, really. But you seem to be almost embracing the middleman. What's going on there?
Well, sure, we were a bit different. That's true, because the conventional wisdom at the time, we set up in the sort of teeth of the dot-com boom, was that the secret, the great strength of the internet, would be disintermediating the middleman. There were a lot of people setting up exchanges involved in the fine wine area when we started. But we took a different approach. We took the view that actually the middleman would remain absolutely crucial in the fine wine market, largely because having come from a financial background, we were aware that we had been trading stocks and we were aware that other commodities were traded electronically and had been for some period of time. And the middleman simply wasn't going out of business. So our idea was, slightly from a different angle, we took the view that fine wine was traded as a commodity, and therefore we felt that an exchange could add a lot of value to the existing marketplace in terms of improving efficiency and adding transparency. And I think that that's largely been proven to be correct.
A lot of people would say that fine wine isn't a commodity. It's a luxurious piece of art. You're a commodity man.
Sure. I think that's true. There is a view that wine is for drinking and not for speculating. And, I'm sympathetic to that view. But actually, it's a bit like saying houses are for living in, or copper is for making into electrical wiring or something like that. That these things are all true. But ultimately, we operate in a free market. And the only way to really ration a scarce commodity in a free market is through price, and therefore there is a market. Speculation has always played a part in the fine wine market, and I think it always will do, unless we decide that the best way to ration wine is to give everyone a thimble. It's always going to be rationed through price. So within that context, there'll always be a marketplace, and our role is merely as a facilitator in that process, to oil the wheels and to make it more convenient, more efficient for the participants in that marketplace to trade.
How do you guys make your money then? Is it through just selling wine and buying wine? You're not brokers yourself?
We're not. We don't own a single bottle of wine.
I bet you do at home.
we do get tempted. This is definitely true. We probably do have more wine than we need personally. No, we purely just take a commission on the way through. Like most exchanges, what LiveX is at its heart is a big database of prices. When people talk about exchanges, they're really talking about exchanges of information. And really, that's our business. Data is LiveX's business, probably more than wine, which is sometimes difficult for some people to get their heads around. But clearly, one of the ways that we make money from our database is by putting a buyer and seller in contact with each other. And for that, we take a commission.
What's the commission?
We charge 2-3% each side. And then we also...
So it's the buyer and the seller.
To the buyer and the seller, that's right.
And can I go on your exchange and buy some wine or sell some wine?
Well, you could only do that through one of our merchant members, because LiveX is, as I said earlier, is only an exchange for middlemen. So all of our customers are merchants or professional traders of one kind or another. So the simple answer to that is no, not directly. The only way you could actually trade on LiveX would be through one of our merchant members. So it would be indirectly, and you'd have to pay them a fee. And as far as Livet's concerned, our customer or our counterparty in any transaction that you did would be with our merchant member and not with you directly.
Oh, it's a shame. What sort of volume do you put through the exchange? Is it, you know, £1,000 a week? Or
Well, we try to do. We try to do £1 million a week. That's what we're set up to do. And you know, we've seen substantial growth over the last 5 or 10 years, particularly as the technology has got better and better. And I mean, interestingly, even though we started off as a dot-com business, it's only really in the last 2 to 3 years that we've done a substantial amount of business online. Initially, at least 90% of our business was transacted over the or agreed on the telephone and then put through online once everything had been agreed. From 2 or 3 years ago, that 10% has increased to about 70% today. So that does give you an indication of just how much the internet has improved over that period of time, over the 8 years or so that we've been in business.
Sure. So about 70% of your work is commission-based, is it?
Yeah, so we generate about 70-75% of our income from commissions, and the balance from subscriptions. Our merchant members pay a membership fee to be a member of LiveX and to use the information that we publish. And we also sell data feeds to mostly, again, to merchants or professional traders. And so data and subscriptions is about 20-25% of our business. And then the balance of about 5%, we've got a small freight forwarding and storage / warehouse services business that does a lot of stock checking and verification work for overseas merchants and wine funds. And we also organize transport all over the world. And also long-term storage.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense. What sort of wines do you deal with? Well, I suppose it is fine wines, but you know, there's lots of fine wines in the world. Where's your volume coming from?
Well, one of the great ironies of the fine wine market is, or the wine market in general, is that it's an incredibly fragmented market. I think we've got 99,000 different commodities listed on our platform. But the vast bulk of our business is actually in relatively few wines. I think last year, around 50% of our business was in the first growth, so in just 5 brands. Mm-hmm. So yes, while the fine wine market is very, very fragmented, in business terms or in economic terms, the fine wine market is very, very concentrated in relatively few names.
Okay, what about other countries? Like Burgundy's quite, you know, got a reasonable fine wine, but it is... It's a bit fragmented, as you say, because of those Napoleonic rules and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, I mean, we do try to do business. The issue really is that Bordeaux is 90% of our business, largely because if you're looking at the high-value wines in the world in which we concentrate, Bordeaux just makes those kinds of wines in much, much bigger volumes. If the average price for a first growth is £3,000 to £4,000, at that price bracket... Anywhere else, in any other region or anywhere else in the world, the producers are going to be making wines at that price level in very, very small quantities and not in the sort of 10 to 20,000 type volumes that the first growths are making them in.
Sure. Okay, that makes sense. So you need both a lot of product and a high price in that product to make it worthwhile for the transactions.
Absolutely. It's all about price times volume, and hence... The economics, when you come to look at add up your turnover at the end of the year, it's very, very Bordeaux and very, very first growth orientated.
Of the other regions, what are the main two or three different producers or regions that really stand out?
The main ones are the classic fine wine regions. Burgundy would be perhaps 2-3% of our business. Champagne would be about the same. Rhone would be about 0.5%. And Italy might be 2-3%. And the balance would be... concentrated in New World wines and Spain, you know, things like Penfolds Grange in Australia, a small amount of things like Opus One, possibly Screaming Eagle in the States. And then in Burgundy, it would be very heavily concentrated in Domaine Romani Conti, but also the other top names like Vogue or Le Flave or Lafon, those sort of very, very high value and sought after names.
Obviously, you've got two people constructing the deal, and you're just saying, this guy wants to buy it, And at that price, this person wants to sell it at that price, give me my commission. But there's more to that than that. There's a lot of credit issues associated with selling and trading. I used to do a bit of energy trading a long time ago, and you know, managing credit risk, particularly at this stage in the sort of economic cycle, is quite important. Do your suppliers or purchasers have to take out insurance against the other person, or what's going on there?
Well, the risk is managed by ourselves because actually LiveX is an anonymous platform. I mean, that's one of the discretion is one of the key bits of value that we add. So the buyer and the seller actually are never introduced to each other on LiveX. So the risk side of things is really managed by us, and it's something clearly that we watch very, very carefully. It's absolutely essential to the smooth running of our marketplace. And as a default position, we actually don't give any credit to anybody. In the instances where people ask for it, we go out and we seek an insured limit. Our buyers are basically insured by credit insurance. Any credit limits on LiveX are set at a strictly arm's length basis by the credit insurer, who's ultimately taking the risk. And we also try to mitigate our risk by vetting members of LiveX extremely carefully. And any new member of LiveX has to be approved by our membership committee. And before even presenting a customer to the membership committee, we will credit check them, we'll take trade references. So we try very, very hard, obviously, to minimize our risk. And it's proved to be pretty successful so far, touch wood. But clearly, the current environment will no doubt prove to be quite testing.
Does the person not release the wine until the other person's been paid, or what's the actual mechanism for transactions to go through?
Well, we have a standard contract on LiveX which determines the condition that the wines must be received by LiveX. So we've got our own warehouse facility, and the vast majority of the cases that come through us are checked, photographed, to make sure that they're in satisfactory condition. The seller basically is obliged to deliver goods to us within 14 days.
Oh, okay. So the seller sells the wine, gives it to you. When you receive the goods, you verify that they're in a good condition.
Yes. The buyer is obligated to pay us within 14 days of month end. In most cases, once we receive the money, we will pay that money to the seller. And we'll then release the goods to the buyer. But we're actually, you know, it's in fact all about minimizing our risk. You know, actually the buyer and the seller's counterparty is us. And the way that we manage our business means that we are very liquid in the sense that we're not holding any stock. So all of our assets and liabilities are matched back to back, so that we have very good cash flow, and we've always maintained a very strong and very liquid balance sheet, so that we can look anybody in the eye and say that we're in a good position to be able to settle any trade that enter into with us on LiveX.
Okay, so you're effectively... Do people take out credit risk against you then?
They could easily do that. They could easily do that, yes. I mean, you know, that's really up to them to do that. We take the view that settling and clearing trades or handling the stock and the payment efficiently is a strong part of why people use LiveX, because there is a sense that there's a high level of assurance that you will get paid, and the stock that you get will arrive on time and will be in the kind of condition that you were hoping it would turn up in.
What about fraud? If I was a member of LiveX and I just happened to have purchased at some time in the future a dodgy bottle of Chateau Margaux or a case of Chateau Margaux, and it just happened that I purchased it, it was fraudulent when I purchased it, and I sell it, and my counterparty says this is fraudulent, what's the comeback?
Well, you know, I mean, I can't think of a single instance where that's happened over 8 years. But if that did happen, we would return the bottle in question or the case in question to the supplier. And I think it's highly likely that the supplier would replace that, because failing to replace it would no doubt damage their reputation. And the thing that really binds LiveX together is the fact that everyone who uses it has a reputation, and they need to trade in the market tomorrow and the next day. So walking away from any transaction is a decision that no one's going to take lightly, because there's no doubt that their reputation would struggle to recover from such a...
Not with another counterparty, because no other counterparty knows who they are. It's their reputation with you.
Yes, absolutely.
So would you ban them from LiveX?
I think we'd have to look at that on a case by case situation. But
because it does, but get...
I think, you know, if someone sold a fraudulent bottle of, or a fraudulent case of wine, and wasn't prepared to, I mean, I can't think of an instance where they wouldn't.
There's lots of cases though. Like there's one in New York where a German supplier is being taken to court by an American for supplying fraudulent wine. And the case is, the argument is whether it's fraudulent or not in the first place, let alone whether. Quite. So there is lots of wiggle room for everybody, really.
Yes, I mean, you know, I think fraud has been a problem in the wine business. No doubt it will be again. It's been a problem in all businesses.
And it's quite a wee bit different from a ton of copper, though, because a ton of copper is a ton of copper.
Yes, I mean, I think there have been instances of fake warrants and fake certificates and that sort of thing in all markets. I think, you know, that wherever there's money involved, there's always a danger that there are going to be crooks too. So this is something that everyone in the trade tries very hard to police, and we're very vigilant about it. In most of the instances, though, you know, we're trading in relatively young wines where the provenance is typically pretty quickly tracked straight back to the chateau. So we haven't found it to be a big problem, but it is a risk that everyone in the wine trade has to live with and to deal with. But it is part and parcel of doing business in our trade.
Okay, then, James, I think we'll wrap it up there. Thank you very much for your time.
Great.